Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
The amount of debt to use and the type of debt to use depends on your circumstances and your objectives. And if you're an entrepreneur trying to make every bit of your insight and ability get put to use, and your capacities are large relative to your financial capacities, debt makes total sense.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzio, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Senziano, I've been waiting a while for this one. This is going to be an enjoyable one. So everybody, you see this? I'm holding a pen. You can take a lot of notes during this podcast because we got
I thought you were going Wolf of Wall Street on me.
You got something to sign for me? No, seriously, listen, everybody. I'm being completely honest. This is going to be a thoroughly enjoyable, entertaining, an educational podcast. We're actually speaking to somebody who's not only just giving his advice, he's actually doing it every day, which is very rare nowadays. People love to give advice and expert opinions when they're not actually doing it. This is going to be enjoyable because this gentleman has been doing it for six decades, and he's just five.
Gino's blurring the truth here.
Well, so. Hey, listen, I'm just trying to get a little more context out there, but listen, he's been doing it for a long time, and he's been through a lot of different administrations, a lot of different market cycles, and most people that are listening right now, a lot of you haven't lost money since 2008. No one's lost money, so they don't have the context. So let's go back. We'll do a little history today. So Jake, without further ado, please.
So today's guest has a unique blend of scholarly rigor and practical business insights, as the G-Dad alluded to. He has used that blend to advise leading corporations for over 35 years. You can learn more about him and his highly acclaimed book, also the Linneman Letter and his real estate finance program. And you can find these at LinnemanAssociates.com. So without further ado, please welcome Dr. Peter Linneman.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it is our pleasure. Now, as Gina was saying, Peter, you have an interesting blend of practical, real-world business success coupled with high-level achievements in academia such as Wharton. You don't see that very often. Just give us a little background on how that happened, because it's kind of like one or the other. You get the professors or you get the people that are actually making it happen. So how'd that work for you?
Probably a short attention span, right? Whereas most people found one thing and just did it. I started my academic career in 1977 at the University of Chicago's Business School. I came to Wharton's Business School in 1979 and was there until I retired 10 years ago from the faculty. However, in 1979, I also started Linneman Associates, which since then has been doing boutique advisory. It evolved also into doing some investing over the last 15 years. I've served on a number of boards. I've served on about 20 corporate boards. I'm on 4 corporate boards now. Have my charity. You guys are young, you might find interesting how my non-academic career started. My non-academic career started in that I was 2 years into my academic career, and I got a phone call from the number 3 executive at the 3rd largest paper company in the world at that time.
Dunder Mifflin.
No, it was Scott Paper back then.
Okay.
And it's long merged away, right? Dunder Mifflin, I understand, is the
office. You got it.
So I got this call, and the guy says, I am. And I understand we want to hire you as a consultant to work for us. And I go, okay. And what do you want me to do? Because I had done, I'd done nothing. And he said, well, we want you to work with us. We're on the largest antitrust suit ever. And we need an economist to advise us. And I'm like 27 or some age, And I had taken the classes and so forth. And I said, sure, which is a good lesson, right? I mean, that's what you guys did with your first apartment, right? Which is, sure. And I'll tell you one other part that was funny. He said, well, can you fly out to meet us? And I said, sure. And he says, what do you charge?
Exactly.
And this is a long time ago. And so I said, $50 an hour. And he said, okay, fine. And I went, like, should have said 60.
Should have said 100 at least.
And, you know, that was the beginning of that exercise, which has continued in various ways, shapes, and form. I haven't done any legal advising since 1990. But, you know, how's your career get started? Odd moments like that. And what really had happened, and I think this is a good lesson for young people. What really happened, I found out later, was they called somebody who should have gotten the job. And that person said, no, I'm not available. The next question the person asked is, well, can you recommend somebody, right? They're looking. And that person had known of me and had met me and had talked to me and said, well, I don't know if he does it, but he's a bright young guy and you ought to, and he'll work hard for you and do it. And the one lesson I always tell young people, whether they were my students, we have about 130 children we sponsor in Kenya. And I tell them, which is, if you do good work, somebody will notice and give you a chance. Mm-hmm. They may not do it in a day or a week or a month or even a year. And my career has really been that, which is I more or less work hard and more or less do good work. And I've been given a lot of chances. Sometimes I don't succeed in those chances. But anyway, I thought your viewers might find that. How do you get a career that's lasted since 1977 started? Yeah.
Love that. Why are you proud that Democrats think you're Republican and vice versa? And what makes them come to that conclusion?
The reason for years, whether it's in my speeches or my writing or platforms like this, when I'm done, invariably hardcore Democrats will say, you're just a damn Republican. And then I'll get my hardcore Republican friends say, you're just a Democrat. And I'm neither. I've never registered Democrat, never registered Republican. And the reason I'm proud of it is I must be shooting fairly straight. Mm-hmm. Because I'm saying enough things to piss off both sides.
You're stinging them.
Yeah. And by the way, it's not like I'm right even when I'm making them mad, but it's not like I've adopted, no pun intended, a party line to make people happy. I try to call them the way I see them without any political bent, if you will.
That's really hard to do that nowadays. It's just so, I mean, with you have all social media coming bearing down on you, you're the devil if you see a Democrat, you're a devil if you're a Republican. It must be very, very difficult. Let me ask you, Peter, what do you find challenging about your profession, being in economics and trying to, you know, advise people? What's really difficult about it?
So what I find interesting or difficult is there's so much information. Mm-hmm. And this has always been true, but there's more and more information available. The question is not just information, it's forming a picture out of that information. Mm-hmm. And I like to say what I do on the advising and the investing side of my life, because if I'm investing, I'm advising myself, right? When you guys are investing, mm-hmm. you may have outside investors, but you're also really advising yourselves, mm-hmm. you know, bouncing.
Yep.
What I like to think of is there is this painter, he's dead now, Seurat. I think it's S-E-U-R-E-T. It was a French, and he was a pointillist, right? And his paintings were all dots, just dots. And so when you're real close to the canvas, all you see are dots. The picture emerges as you move away. And I think if I have a skill, one of them is don't move so far away, because if you move so far away, you can't even see the painting, right? But if you get too close, all you see are dots. Mm-hmm. And the trick is to get far enough away to see the picture. Mm-hmm. And I don't always succeed in that. Sometimes I think it's a picture of a person out for a walk and it's a dog, right? You make mistakes. But that's the challenge, is to get all these dots, not just GDP or not just that or not just that. So one of the things I do when I meet my friends or a new person in business is I'll ask them, how's business? And I care, because in addition to all this statistical data, I want to hear that them saying, well, we're doing well, but nobody's buying hamburgers, right, at my restaurant. Well, why is nobody buying hamburgers? What is that? There's something going on. Mm-hmm. And to try to get dots and to see where the dots fit, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
It does. Peter, this is Jake and Gino doing deals 2013 to 2020. This is us doing deals today.
We're holding our noses.
I'm holding my nose. I'm holding my crotch, and we see the danger.
Now it's getting dirty with it.
I'm just saying, we see the danger and the allure. And my question to you is, you know, everyone out there can spout, and they may be right, they may be wrong. They never fact check. We know there's inflation. We know that the Fed is pumping money. We know, I heard another podcast who said that if you're going to give Beavis and Butthead money, they're going to go buy AC/DC shirts. So you're giving the banks money. So what are the banks going to do? They're going to continue to lend. But at a point in time where cap rates are so compressed and rates of return are so low, and there's so much risk that we're taking on, we're using bridge debt to buy stabilized deals, hoping that interest rates don't go up. Where do you see asset prices going? Do you see them continuing to rise?
So a couple of comments. One is, I don't try to time. Mm-hmm. I don't try to time. And by the way, there are people who try that. There are people who succeed
at that.
Good
luck with that. Yeah.
Good luck with that. It's mm-hmm. a very hard thing. And therefore, I think one of the most important research studies I've done was we looked at 10-year hold returns for real estate. My colleague Jeremy Siegel wrote a very famous book called Stocks for the Long Run, where he did that for stocks and bonds and gold and so forth and so on over a very long period of time. So we ran 10-year holds on different kinds of real estate, unlevered. Mm-hmm. And you know what you found out? Is that on unlevered apartments, you do about a 9% return over a decade, sometimes mm-hmm. a little better, sometimes a little worse, never negative. Mm-hmm. And on industrial, you do about a 9% return. And on retail, and you get the point that if it's good stuff, you're going to have bad times and good times. But over a decade, you do pretty well. And then if you put a little leverage on it, that 9 becomes a 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And if you get lucky at the right moment. Interestingly, we found if you do 3-year holds, you do a lot higher, but you also do a lot lower. Mm-hmm. Same real estate, right? It's this, the real estate doesn't know if you're holding it for 3 years or 10 years. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that is you're right that it kind of feels risky at times, mm-hmm. unless you say, I'm going to hold it for a decade. And then go back, even if you'd have bought at the peak, and you to come back a decade later, you did okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of good assets. And mm-hmm. When I say good assets, it doesn't have to be the greatest asset. Can't be the worst asset, right? Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend, former student, who owns like the worst trailer parks. And you may as well be a specialist in dealing with 911, right? That's a different kind of exercise. But, you know, just decent real estate. So that's one comment I'd make, which is over a decade, I'd be almost willing to guarantee that anything you buy today, if you hold it a decade and you finance it 50 to 75% debt, you'll do fine. Mm-hmm. You'll pull your hair out.
Fixed for the 10 years too. So you're taking the interest rate risk off the table, right?
You're taking the interest rate risk off. At least for 10 years, you're taking the interest rate. Mm-hmm. The other comment I'd have is I remember when everybody said, gee, cap rates are all the way down to 8%. They can't go any lower. They can't possibly go any lower. And then they went to 6. And then they can't possibly go any lower. Then they went to 5. And, you know, you get the point. And in the last decade, and I think the next decade, you hit it. There has been so much unprecedented money pumped into the system that over the next decade, that money has to come out chasing not AC/DC shirts, because they didn't give it to Beavis and Butthead, but they gave it to banks, and they're going to give it to asset buyers. Mm-hmm. And asset buyers are going to chase assets. And if you made me bet, and I hope I'm around in a decade, which is I think you're going to see cap rates 10% lower than they are today, systemically, not necessarily on every asset, mm-hmm. not necessarily every day, but systemically. Why? There's just so much more money that's been created by the bank, by the Fed and the banking system, with more to come. Mm-hmm. Where's it go? And the thought experiment I always do, people say, yes, but what if interest rates rise? What happens to the values? I'm going to do a thought experiment. You guys are smart. What if I told you a year from now, there's twice as much money chasing your apartment buildings? What happens to the cap rates on your apartment buildings?
Go down.
Go down. By the way, you didn't say it depends on interest rates, did you? Mm-hmm. Nope. You answered your own question in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the weight of money. Now, yep. If I told you there was going to be, I don't know, 3% more money, 2% more money, then you might ask about interest rates, right? But the flow of money, well, we're talking about just staggering amounts of money have been created. Why is it staggering? Literally unprecedented in the history. Amounts of money have been created. And I think
25% of the current money supply or something, right?
Put it this way. The monetary base of the United States was about $800 billion at the beginning of the third quarter of 2008. Not that long ago, right? 13 years ago. It was $800 billion from the beginning of the nation to then. It's $7 trillion today, 13 years later. Okay, got it?
Yep.
Now, I don't know that does a 9 times. Right? Because not all of that money is going to come out of the system, right? Some of it's staying in the banking system as reserves and so on. But $800 billion, that took for the entire history of the country to trillions, multiples, it's got to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's going to go to assets primarily. It's going to go, and it's what it's done in the last decade, and it's what it's going to do again in the next decade.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't bet on that in a week. I wouldn't bet on that for a month or a year. If you told me you have to be out in 2 years, I would never make that bet. If you told me you have to be out in a decade, I'd make that bet.
Using your restaurant analogy, if you're asking me, you know, how's my business doing, at least on the buy side, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing folks that can't find operators, that can't find the ceiling yet because they keep printing money. Rents continue to go up, but they're on 12-month leases. So we can't literally catch up to what market rate is. That's what we've been seeing. And we're in a growing market. We operate in the Southeast. We were bidding on an asset. It was $31 million. Okay. The average rents were about $995. The true market, and we had comps to back it up, were about $1,500. Yeah. So you had to literally buy the thing with bridge, even though you could see the destination.
Right.
And
right.
Short term, that doesn't feel good. But to your point, if you're holding for 10 years, you're committing to long-term, you know, fixed rate debt, it probably works. It just feels probably. Like shit now when you're buying it, because you're used to buying immediate cash on cash, where you're like, you got to prepay it now. And that's the difference. It doesn't feel great as a buyer.
It doesn't but feel great. It's there. It, you have to believe, right? It's there. That's why you really want to underwrite it. You don't want to just say, oh, gee, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's one footnote. The footnote is make sure you can cover your debt if it doesn't get there. Right?
You got to break even. Yeah.
You got to cover. You got to cover. The reason is there's been a lot of people who have been right that the rents are going to get to 1500, but you aren't around to see it because you got squeezed out because you couldn't cover your debt.
Before you got there, yeah.
Before you got there. And my number one piece of advice, probably one of the biggest lessons I learned from when I was young to today when I'm 70, is you got to cover. You got to give yourself cushion that even if income drops 10 or 15%, I cover until the good times come, and the good times will come, but you got to be around to see them. You don't want to be the one who provided the great opportunity for the next buyer.
For the next guy. Oh, yeah.
And that's the thing. So people used to talk a lot about loan to value, loan to value, loan to value. And I said, stop talking about loan to value. talk about coverage, 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 coverage. Mm-hmm. If you've got coverage, you'll be able to figure out loan to value, right?
Yep.
If you don't have coverage, I don't care what loan to value is because value can change. But if I've got coverage, even after in apartments, right, 10, 15%, you don't get drops in apartment incomes more than 10 to 15%. And by the way, if you got a 30% drop in apartment incomes on something reasonably well managed, the economy's got a bigger problem than just you. You would agree?
Yes.
It's the practical business sense coming out, Gino. This isn't the professor. This is someone that's invested before.
That's because right. He's got some scars. Ourselves,
it's cash on cash, right? We're looking at, you know, everyone's talking, well, IRR, we buy our own stuff. We want to know what's our cash on cash. And number one, are we going to be able to cover that nut? So that's beautiful.
So Jake, wise man once told me, the only times you really care about the value of real estate is when you buy and when you sell. I think those are the only two times you really need to focus on it because you want to buy it right.
Otherwise, you're just puffing out your chest. I'm rich, right?
We have a three-step framework. Exactly. You can't eat net worth. You either buy right, you manage right, and you finance right. Peter, this is very important. I know this is near and dear to Jake's heart, this question. How is shortage of labor affecting the recovery? Because right now it is very difficult to find great labor out there. I mean, we've created our core values, our mission statement. We've really tried to build a really amazing, you know, entity for our employees and to empower them. We have net promoter scores. And even us, we're still having troubles retaining employees and even finding, you know, employees to fill some seats. I'm sure a lot of employers out there are having the same issues that we are.
Sure. So what we have is a very odd, unintended economic situation where until September 6th and since March until September 6th, huge numbers of work, potential work, are making more unemployed than employed. And to be more precise, if you previously had a job and you're on unemployment, you make more unemployed. Then you do work. By the way, if it's your kid and they just graduated from high school, they can't collect unemployment, right? So they actually have to go to work. So the youth unemployment is really low right now by historic standards. So the labor market's strong, youth unemployment is low. But why are there so many open jobs? Basically because and this is approximate, if you make $25 an hour or less, so $50,000 a year, just quick numbers. You make more not working than working. And in fact, you could be making as much as 30% more not working than working. Now, that's about half of the population. That's about half of the population. It's not quite, it's like 45%. Of the population is until September 6th making more not working than working. That's odd. And is it surprising then that you have a lot of openings? And by the way, it's worse than what it first sounds like. It first sounds like, well, okay, but those people making more than $25 an hour. No, imagine you could make $25 an hour not working and $26 an hour working. You're really only making a dollar an hour by your efforts.
Yep.
Right. So they tell you they're paying you 26. You're only a dollar an hour better. Nobody's going to work for a dollar an hour. So the real impact is much larger than it sounds because of the fallback. That evaporates on September 6th. I can't imagine they'll extend it.
What do you see happening, though? I mean, all of a sudden, people that didn't have jobs, they're going to have to scramble back. And there are a lot of jobs open, but there's going to be a lot of people looking for a lot fewer jobs. And those people that held on and only got a buck an hour, they may be saying to themselves, hey, I only got a buck an hour, but at least I've got a nice, safe, secure job.
And so I think you hit it. I think you hit it. I think there's two effects. By the way, nothing happens on September 7th, right? I mean, it's not like
it's going to take time.
Yes.
Having said that, it'll start sinking in September 8th, September 9th. Oh, my unemployment check is a lot smaller. And the 12th and the 22nd, and I don't have as much money for groceries because my unemployment check and so forth. And so I think late September, October, into November, the reality is going to sink in. I think you're right that those people who took the job are going to look like geniuses because they were first in line. They're ahead of the others. And there'll be a mad scramble to get back to work in a lot of jobs. Mm-hmm. And you'll see 3 to 4 million job spurt happen that should have happened over the last 6 months, happen over the next 3 months. Mm-hmm. And in addition to the normal, why is that important to the economy? Yes, those people have money to spend right now, right? They have money to spend, mm-hmm. but they're not producing anything. Mm-hmm. It's like money for nothing, right? The old song, money for nothing. What will happen is they will actually be producing. What does that mean? Service will be better at the restaurant. There'll be more workers available to check people in to the luggage claim at the airport and so forth. And so the economy will be better off, mm-hmm. not just because they have money to spend. They're not going to have so much more money to spend, but because they're producing something. Yeah. So, and that's what society's about.
So, Peter, let me ask you a question then. Do wages drop? Because everyone's talking about the minimum wage. Uh-huh. Here in Florida, you can't get somebody to wash dishes for less than $15 an hour with healthcare. No, I'm not saying that they drop, but I mean, are those unrealistic $15 an hour dishwashing jobs when you should be paying 9 or 10? Do those go back down to 11 or 12, or do they stay at the elevated price?
That is a real rubber meets the road problem. By the way, in a classroom, what's the answer? In a classroom, supply equal demand, wage will drop.
The answer is yes, but I don't think it's right. happening.
But mm-hmm. I think what in reality happens, and as somebody who's employed people, you've been a loyal employee. You've been working hard. Yes. You've been there all summer working mm-hmm. at $18 an hour when you should have been getting $14 if none of this had existed. I can't cut you to 14. Yep. I can't say you've been my best employee and thank you. And you were here and thank you very much. Here's a $4 reduction. So there'll be stickiness. Mm-hmm. And what that stickiness will do is dampen how fast people get hired versus mm-hmm. textbook. But it will also, I think, breed a degree of loyalty in a strange sort of way of those that were already there. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I do think that some people are going to have to go to two-tiered. It's interesting you raise this because several companies that I advised, I told them, don't raise your wage, do signing bonuses, do lottery tickets for them, do something so that it's burnt off. Free rent, right?
Yeah.
Give free rent. So when it's gone, you've got market rent, right?
Yes.
The same thing applies. Signing bonuses will deal much smoother than the ones who just, quote, raise the wage. And that'll be stickier.
Love that.
Guys, real quick on this. The one thing that's going to prevent the wages from coming down is this intangible COVID thing that we're dealing with. And from a practical employer standpoint, what we're dealing with, we have a little over 50 employees. We're 4 maintenance positions short right now. Okay. Doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Should be a fine. What right. happens is the kid gets sick. Now there's these protocols in place. So now the maintenance tech is out or in isolation because their kid or they came into, you know, contact with the COVID. And so now this happens in 3-4 different locations. Now it's not 4 or 3 employees that you're short, you're short 8. And this is going to continue until this becomes a more accepted component of society, like the flu or something more comforting to people that they can actually deal with. Right now, it's still very big and very scary. So it's actually a multiplier effect with COVID in place. So I don't think you're going to see the dip because you're going to continue to be strained at times and need to get the folks in to make sure fulfillment's taking place.
Yeah, and I think even go one step farther is until the school systems get themselves
that's the child care
figured out, you've got the child care conundrum. I don't claim to have a solution. I'm just saying the conundrum. Correct. So you're right. And the reason I think it's only 3 or 4 million jobs rather than 5 or 6 is I'm kind of factoring in what you're saying.
Yeah.
Is that absent any of this stuff, absent the wages were artificially high, absent the I am COVID or I have to be COVID or the school, I think you'd get closer to 5 to 6 million jobs in that time period pop rather than 3 to 4. So I've already kind of, I'm not saying I'm right in how I factored it, but I've tried to factor that component in as best I can. By the way, this is not a statistical model when I say I factored it in. It's, I'm just trying to look at reality and do what you're talking about. Sure. And that's where I come out.
I've got two words, actually one word for the school system. Homeschool. I've got six kids. We've homeschooled six kids. Two of them in college. The four are doing okay. It's a lifestyle. It ain't easy, people. But if you adapt to it, man, you can rock it and your kids will actually be normal. And you know, years ago, 20 years ago, when I started homeschooling, it was like, these kids are in the corner picking their noses. Nowadays, homeschoolers are pretty cool people. So things have changed in 20 years. People want to homeschool. So, I mean, just putting that out there, Peter.
The interesting thing is we don't have children. The interesting thing is, and therefore our children would have been the only perfect children in the world because they would have had the only perfect parents in the world. No, the only problem with homeschooling that I've always thought is if your parent is an idiot, now you're stuck with an idiot for a parent and an idiot for a teacher.
Whereas the kid's got to figure it out.
Yeah. Some people, you know, gee, my parent's an idiot, but my teacher was pretty good or vice versa. Right. So there's this double down risk.
That's why we love you, Peter. You're just a practical person. It's not just academics. You're really thinking deeply about these things. And listen, I've known a lot of homeschool parents who are idiots. So I can definitely concur with what Peter's saying. So I love that. Yeah. Let's talk about the geniuses, how they made another mistake. And I was listening to another podcast about the savings rate. The savings rate during the pandemic, we were supposed to go into this credit card debt and all. That's why they're always wrong, these geniuses. They always create these problems and then try to create the solutions. But tell us what happened with the savings rate. I was blown away by this.
So it was probably the biggest early prediction I made, because you can imagine my phone was ringing off the hook and all clients and people wanted me and so forth. What's going to happen? So my March 2020 was insane because you're trying to absorb what's the science. You're trying to go back and see what's happened in past downturns. There's never been a source of a downturn like this. There was 1919, but they didn't shut down the same way. Mm-hmm. There was the yellow fever in 1789 in Philadelphia. And you're trying to read any studies on that. Okay. Normally what happens in a downturn is people lose their jobs, companies can't give bonuses, people blow through their savings, they don't do things because they don't have any savings, they try to hang on and so forth. This was totally unprecedented. And once, it took me till about the second week of April to appreciate it, which was lots of people still had jobs. And with the federal money that came way faster than anybody would have anticipated. Forget whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. It came faster than anybody anticipated. It was there by late March last year and early April. And so people still had income. What happened was there was nothing to spend it on. And at the same time, massive numbers of people had involuntary savings. What's involuntary savings? I got my Sixer ticket refund. I got my vacation that I was going to go on to Disney. I didn't go on. Mm-hmm. So I had all this money and I'm not eating out at work. I'm not, you know, even driving the car much. And the savings rate went from about 7% to 33%. I mean, think
33.
About it.
33%, guys. Holy
30%.
Crap.
Beer now, went through the roof, though. People were buying a lot of beer.
There were some things, but there wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I said, well, since I'm not going to take a 2-week vacation to Disney, I'm going to buy however many. That's a lot of beer. That's a lot of beer to buy.
Right? Aluminum going crazy, right?
So there was a little of that, but, you know, so savings went just out of sight. To appreciate what a 33% savings rate means versus a 7%, I'm going to take a household making $100,000, which, by the way, could be one person making $100,000, it could be one at 70 and one at 30, it could be two at 50. So we're not talking staggering incomes, we're talking normal workers. It meant you were saving $7,000 a year, of which 4,000 was your 401k, which you couldn't touch. Mm-hmm. So you only had 3,000 of savings you could touch, use to buy a home or a car or whatever. Now, when it goes to 33%, you have 33,000 in savings, four of which is still your 401k, 29,000 in a year is you can use for whatever you want, 29,000. Well, that's like 10 years of what you had accumulating for whatever you wanted. So what did people do? They used it for down payments. They bought cars. Mm-hmm. They did those type of
and
things.
Car and production plummeted, right? Car production plummeted, so it made it even more higher demand. Yeah.
And so you had this totally unexpected phenomenon. Now, by the way, the savings rate, as things opened up, is back down to about 12%. So, and I'll give you one other thing. By the way, it fed the single family market, this phenomenon I just described, because you need a down payment. It's not the monthly, right? It's the down payment. Mm-hmm. I can make the monthly, but if I can't make the down payment, I can't own a home. Mm-hmm. When you went from 7% savings to 33% savings for 6 to 10 months, people had down payment. And I'll give you the other one. And you've not seen this or heard this. I've not heard anybody else say it. Probably 300,000 to 500,000, quote, young people. And by that, I mean the inheritors of the people who were over 70 that died 2, 4, 5, 10 years early of COVID, not the one that died 6 days early, the ones that died 2, 5, 10 years early. Grandma gave them a bequest last year and into this year through 3, 4, 5 years earlier than they expected it. Mm-hmm. And those bequests were 20, 50, 80, 100,000. What did they do with that savings? It went from grandma to somebody who could do a down payment. Mm-hmm. And so you saw that surge that was unprecedented, just unprecedented, because we've never had people die like that. And when we did, they were young people that died, not old people. And when they were old people, like during the Spanish flu, they didn't have any money. So it was a totally strange phenomenon. Awesome. So the savings phenomena, I still don't think people appreciate this. Grandma died early because of COVID and I got an inheritance and I'm going to do something different with my money than grandma would.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Let me ask you about inflation. How does calculating inflation through consumer prices skew the number? Because inflation is important. I mean, we all know it's there. It's all visible. Now they're talking about thinking about adding rent growth, rent increases into CPI. I mean, what are your thoughts on it?
Okay, so this time I went to graduate school in 1973 at University of Chicago, studying under Milton Friedman and a whole bunch of things. And I remember back then, one of the first classes was studying how do you form consumer price indexes and price indexes in general and their problems. And the problems have not changed. The problems that new products come, new products improve, new products come, old products disappear. And do you include asset prices? Because asset prices are prices. A home is something you pay for. Cars. Is you know, car prices are in there. Why aren't home prices? And why not stock prices? That's something you pay for and so forth, right? And in the last years, two items have become a problem. They've always been known as a problem. One is housing and the other is healthcare. And by the way, everybody knows healthcare costs have gone up staggering. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you look at what happened in the consumer price index, it didn't go up that much. Mm-hmm. And that's largely because it was being absorbed by employers and your wage was lower as a result than it would have otherwise been. Mm-hmm. But come on, those prices went up. They were inflated. And the other was homes. And they have a mechanism. Actually, I did some research on the mechanism way back when, did one of the early, quote, important papers on it as an academic. Look, the real thing is we know there's inflation. What we had in the last decade prior to the last year was not a lot of consumer price inflation as traditionally measured. but a lot of asset price inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Apartments went up in value. Homes went up in value. By the way, homes going up in value is great if you're an owner and terrible if you're a buyer, but that's no different than bread. If bread goes up in price, it's great for the seller and bad for the buyer, right? Mm-hmm. We ignored asset price inflation. And the Fed explicitly says, yes, asset price inflation is part of inflation, but we don't want to tinker in that market.
How are they not tinkering in that market?
And
they're causing the impact of that market.
They are. You got it. So there's no perfect way to do this. The only good thing you can say about the mismeasurement of prices and mismeasurement inflation is it's not political. It's not being it's not like down in Argentina where it's being manipulated for a clearly political purpose. It's being done by a bunch of technicians trying to do a good technical job. How do you compare your iPhone 13 to the smartphone of 10 years ago? You know,
I kind of liked the BlackBerry. It was durable. I could throw it against the wall. I mean, it wasn't bad. I enjoyed both, right?
I still have one. I use my iPhone more, but I still have one as a backup in case the world ends. So we have inflation. There's no doubt we have inflation. However, you know, the big headline consumer price inflation, do you realize that, I think it was 5.5% or something like that year over year? Well, 20% of that was used cars. 20% of the entire 5.whatever% increase was attributable to the used car component. By the way, if you didn't buy a used car, do you care?
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
So here was this big announced inflation that the only people who cared about it were used car buyers. On the other hand, there are other inflations that work the other way. So I'll tell you what I tend to follow, and I'll give you why. I tend to follow more the inflation of service prices. And
that's
the
been
reason
going up.
Is we're a service economy. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I know we have goods. The measurement of services is not as difficult as trying to compare an iPhone 13 to its
My home cleaners is up over 10%. I know that. Much.
Yeah.
All right. And they're struggling to staff. So
services is a much better metric. Mm-hmm. Not better. Probably truer. There's no true here, but mm-hmm. truer.
Impacts and more people, maybe.
The other I follow is asset prices. And I'm in the asset business, and assets are real prices. And by the way, you know, this whole discussion about inequality. A lot of that comes out of asset price inflation, right? If you own the asset, you win. If you didn't own it, you lost because you have to pay more to get it. And I don't think people have intellectually figured it out, but they look at somebody and say, you know, that little Cape Cod house that 40 years ago was $40,000 is now $1 million in California, and I can't afford it. And it's just a bullshit little house. And so there's a lot of political undercurrents relate to us ignoring asset price inflation. And let's be honest, the Fed intentionally during the financial crisis fed asset price inflation. They knowingly did. Why? Because they didn't want everybody to default on their debt. And they did it again this time, right? Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want everybody to default on their debt. Why did the Fed not want everybody to default on their debt? Because their first responsibility is to maintain the banking system. And if everybody defaults on their debt, what happens to the banking system? And the Fed said, I don't want to know. And the way I'm going to never find out is put enough money in to support asset prices. And that's why I go back to where we were half an hour ago. I think moving forward, asset prices go up from all the money they put in.
Love that. Last long question for you. What investments or assets would you stay away from?
Okay, so I'll answer three things. Anything you don't understand at all.
Mm-hmm.
is generally a good answer. And my friend Sam Zell and I sometimes talk, and we sometimes say that we've heard a million, and he's heard more than have I, but you've heard a million investment pitches. And if at the end of it, you actually think to yourself, I don't have any idea what they're talking about, don't invest. And because you're not that dumb, you're a smart enough guy, it's just investing. If you don't understand, there's probably a reason it's bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean all of them, but stay away. So number one rule, don't invest if you really don't understand. By the way, you don't have to understand how the product is made, but you do need to understand how do you make money, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have to understand how concrete is made to buy an apartment complex, but I do need to understand it's in a neighborhood, people want to live there, they're willing to pay this kind of rent, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's number one. Number two, don't invest for a day, a week, a month, or a year. You know, invest for years at minimum, and 7 to 10 better, because it covers your mistakes and we all make them, mm-hmm. okay? In that you're probably right with your theme, but you may not be right with your timing. That's the second. So don't invest what you don't know, and generally don't invest short term. And the third is, don't try to be smarter than you are. This is a corollary of don't invest in what you don't know. And I think a lot of people do. By the way, my biggest problem as an investor is I overthink things. By the way, think about it. PhD, economics, Nobel Prize winners, and so forth. Come on. My nature, by nature, tends to overanalyze stuff, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes it's not that complicated. Sometimes it isn't that complicated. And you can overanalyze something and do something you convince yourself of the trivial rather than focus on the main, and vice versa. So there's a right amount of analysis. And I say my biggest shortcoming as an investor is I probably overanalyze. I want to understand, you know, where did this start in the Middle Ages? How did the Middle Ages monks have an influence on the demand that's happening today? You know, mm-hmm. so, but yeah, don't invest in what you don't know, and don't try to flip. It's too hard.
Mm-hmm. I like that. All right, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Are you looking for ways to improve your life?
Here at Jake and Gino, our mission is to empower students through financial education and the vehicle of multifamily investing.
Yes, Jake. We agree that a person with financial intelligence can change the world for the better.
We've created our proprietary three-step framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right, that we teach to our community. This framework, along with education, our one-on-one mentorship, on-site boot camps, and the amazing community, has propelled our students to massive success.
We've all been there. We've had so many students that have been able to shift their mindset, overcome limiting beliefs, and set a clear path to achieve their goals. Whether you're currently fixing and flipping, wholesaling, or buying single-family rentals, and you know that multifamily investing is the right vehicle for you, I encourage you to visit jakeandgino.com/apply to schedule your complimentary consultation with our team. And I want to let you know, this isn't a high pressure sales call. It's really just a discovery call to get to know each other better and see if we're a good fit for working together. And if for any reason we're not a good fit, our team has tons of resources we will share with you to help you along your journey.
If you're ready to stop spinning your wheels, go to jakeandgino.com/apply and schedule your call now. All right, we're back. Earlier, you mentioned buying for the long term if you're in a good asset. Now, our folks probably want to hear from you what a good asset means to you. If you were out there shopping an apartment complex, what type of parameters would you be looking for to classify something as a good asset or good fundamentals there?
Okay, number one is, are you going to make more calls to 911? And I'm kind of joking, but I'm not, right?
So the management component.
So, yeah. Are you going to be mostly, is your management going to be dealing a lot with 911 calls, right? Or are they going to be instead dealing with, I've got a leak, or et cetera, et cetera. Right. So I don't have expertise in dealing with the police. I have expertise in dealing in real estate. Now, that doesn't mean you can't make money in dealing with the police. It's a different skill. Don't confuse the two. So that would be number one. The number two would be look at the property with stark realism and ask yourself if in this market, 10 years from now, nobody is going to want to live in this neighborhood or this property anymore. And there's always a property that gets torn down, right? Every year there's properties that get torn down, right? Or go, either they get torn down or they become 911 communities, right? Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. And so you don't want to buy it 2 years before it comes a 911 community, right? If you cannot honestly say to yourself, this community will not still be around and competitive, doesn't have to be A+, right? But it's not going to be around and competitive, which has to do with the neighborhood, the property, and how much new product comes on. Because if everybody's building A+, pretty soon a B is a D, right? Because the A+ filters down. So, but the point is, there are good C properties, right? There are good C properties. And there are horrible C properties because they'll be gone, right? Or they'll be 911 community. So when I say good in terms of apartments, and obviously they have to be structurally sound. You don't want to get fooled. That's underwriting, making sure what you're getting is what you're paying for. But by good property, it doesn't have to be an A++. Those are easier to identify as a good property, but it doesn't have to be that.
No, I think that's fair, because like you're saying, if you're in it for the long term, where's the ceiling? We know rents are going up if you're in a good market that has demand. So get in, lock with a low rate and ride it out. What assets are you personally investing in right now?
Well, obviously in the real estate space, our main focus right now is apartments. I like the spread. I like the fact that we're doing some opportunity zone investing where we have to be part of the development process, but also some non-opportunity zone stuff. I like the spread. I like the fact that Freddie and Fannie are there, as well as the banks and life insurance companies and other lenders. But Freddie and Fannie provide a deep, deep financing pool with discipline, with a good degree of discipline in terms of coverage and LTV. I like the fact that by historic standards, cap rates may be low, but spreads are not so low. Spreads over 10-year treasury, spreads over my borrowing costs. Mm-hmm. You're right that if you're in a transitional property, it can get uncomfortable. But by and large, spreads are pretty good. Look, if I told you, here's $100 million, and all I want is a decent property at a 5 cap in the U.S. in a market of a metro area of what, 800,000 or more, you wouldn't have much trouble finding a property. You'd have to bid for it. And so it wouldn't be an A, mm-hmm. but you could get me a solid B at a 5 cap. Okay. What can I borrow at on that solid 5 cap?
2.8.
Three, right? Yeah. Something like that. I can borrow 65% at 3. You do the math. Infinite coverage, huge cash flow, and I'm locked in for 10 years. You know, and I'll take that all day long. And by the way, even if I go to a 4 cap, move up the food chain, I can still borrow at 3. And you're still doing pretty well. Coverage, not as well. And so if you said what I really, really like, I like markets where I can pick up 50 basis points, 25 basis points on the cap rate, and I can borrow at the same rate from Freddie and Fannie. And I'll take the spread and cash flow for the next 8-10 years. And, you know, it's not a bad deal.
You mentioned Fannie and Freddie a few times, and don't think it's our listener base, but what do you say to someone like a Dave Ramsey who's out there saying, you know, all debt is bad and people should have no debt? I mean, this just seems a little crazy, but I'm just curious to see what you say to that.
I have a couple of clients, very high wealth families, extraordinary high wealth families, who don't borrow or don't borrow
at all.
Their point is, I got a hard time putting my money to work. The last thing I need is, you know, I find a good opportunity. I want to put my money to work. Yes. If you then go borrow 65% of it, I got to find
some more.
Got to find more. And it's hard to find.
They're getting lazy. They're getting lazy, Peter.
And so these families, not typical, their view is it's hard. And I think they're right. It's hard to find great deals that you believe in for the long term. When you find them, if you don't need the money and you're having a hard time putting out the money, do it all equity or do it 70% equity or whatever. Let's face
this was, this was your chance to be confrontational and give us some juice for a little, you know, snippets out there. Come on.
Here's the flip side. And it's in my book. Why do most entrepreneurs borrow? Real simple. They don't have the money, right? It's that simple. And so if you told most entrepreneurs, if I took you guys and I said, you know,
it's not recourse. It doesn't count.
You're worth what Jeff Bezos is worth and it's all liquid.
Yeah.
You'd be scrambling like hell to put it to work and your appetite for debt would go way down.
Fair enough.
But as an entrepreneur, your abilities exceed your capital capabilities, and debt fills that gap, or to some extent fills that gap. And there's no magic answer on debt. What's right for one, you know, the thing I say it in the book, I used to say it in class, what are the right clothes to wear? Well, it depends. Are you going to your mother's funeral or are you going to the beach with your boyfriend? Totally different, same person, but totally different attire. The amount of debt to use and the type of debt to use depends on your circumstances and your objectives. And if you're an entrepreneur trying to make every bit of your insight and ability get put to use, and your capacities are large relative to your financial capacities, debt makes total sense. And then you just want to make sure you don't get squeezed, back to our earlier conversation. But if you've got
good coverage throughout the LTV, I'm paying
good
attention.
Good coverage throughout the LTV. On the other hand, if your ambitions are small, your abilities to execute are small, and your capital capacity is large, why borrow? I mean, why borrow? Why give up any of the juice, so to speak?
I think there's a joke out there about, you know, weathermen and economists, but I'm not too sure exactly what that was. But we have you on right now. So in the next 12 to 18 months, any insights that could add value to the listenership for the U.S. economy?
Don't bet against the U.S. economy. It's historically been a bad bet. And it's been a bad bet almost no matter who's in the White House. It's been a bad bet no matter who's in Congress. We've had plenty of weak players in both. It's been a bad bet no matter what the tax structure is or isn't. It's been a bad bet no matter what catastrophes befall us, foreign and domestic. Don't bet against the U.S. economy. And that is something I have to remind myself of and all the time, not just now. I have to constantly remind myself. It's been, you know, in the history of this country, it's been a bad bet to bet against the U.S. economy. It might be a good bet for a year or two, right? But not on any kind of hold that I focus on. And if I gave people one walk away, that would be it. And the other would be, I guess, don't try to time. I go back to what I said, you know, try to think you're in this for 10 years. Try to find capital that will stay with you for 10 years. There's going to be good times and bad times. In a decade, 2 years are going to be way worse than you ever thought they could be. 2 years are going to be way better than you ever thought they would be. And six more or less are going to be like you thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So be there to enjoy all of them.
Peter, before the show, you're telling us you have a book coming out that's not essentially down the fairway for you. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, that's nice you would ask. It's a book I've done with Albert Ratner, who is a real estate legend of Forest City. Albert's 94 now, and is very involved in Cleveland Clinic, one of the major medicals in the world. Mm-hmm. And his friend and my friend, Dr. Mike Roizen, who's a best-selling medical person. He's head of wellness at Cleveland Clinic for many years, a real medical, you know, epidemiologist type. They were working on, not only are we going to live longer in the trend sense. When Albert Ratner was born, he's 94 now, his life expectancy when he was born was 57. If I told you somebody being born's life expectancy is 57, you'd say that's crazy. I'm 70. My life expectancy at birth, I think, was 65. That's only 70 years ago, right? So not only is there that trend, but all this gee whiz science, genetic engineering, and so forth that you read about a little bit in the newspaper when you're not reading about, you know, political crazy stuff, is going to change the world. And it's going to change the world the way that when we came up with antibiotics changed the world, when we came up with vaccines changed the world, and so forth. And not only are you going to see a linear increase in trend, but you're going to see a jump, not overnight jump.
Well, what kind of stuff, though? Are we talking like pensions to 401ks because people are living longer? What kind of kind of impact?
It has implications for everything, because if I told you you're going to live, and guys your age are, if I told you you're going to live to 110, your first reaction is, I don't want to. Because
you kind of be ugly at that point, right?
But that's because you think of living 30 more years like your grandmother's last year. It's not what's going to be. It's going to be like your tire. Tires used to last 10,000 miles. Now they last 120,000 miles, but they don't live that extra 110,000 miles on that last year of bald rubber, right? Mm-hmm. And so living to 110, you're going to get two more years in your 20s, two more years of your 30s, two more years of your 40s. But so forth. Your last year is still going to be probably pretty poor. Mm-hmm. That means you're going to work longer. You're going to want to work longer. You're going to have to work longer. You're going to be productive longer. You're going to have to save more.
He's saying buy assets, folks, buy assets that can pay for this life.
You got it. Yeah. Have a disciplined approach to saving. By the way, it also says this isn't going to come in the next 6 minutes. So you're going to have to start taking care of your body a bit better, mm-hmm. because you want to be there when the cavalry arrives, right? You don't want to die just before these breakthroughs occur. And these breakthroughs are stunning. When you read the science, so to speak, is stunning. I mean, they've turned dogs into half their age. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
Imagine a nightmare to me, because I can't get rid of mine. It's 17. And I'm like, just when's he going to go already?
There you go. But imagine LeBron James. Imagine if LeBron James got the muscular, he has all the wisdom he has from his playing to date, and he has the musculature and the recovery time that he had 15 years ago.
You're talking about Tom Brady.
And imagine Tom Brady if he'd be playing until he's 90, right? So they've done this kind of stuff. Imagine they've turned fat so that it burns faster. Just burns faster genetically, by genetic altering. Well, suddenly obesity and so forth and all those related diseases become a massive less. So, for example, I'll give you, and then I'll stop. We spend about 18% of GDP on healthcare. Of that, 80% or 14% of GDP is spent on chronic diseases. Okay? 14% of GDP.
Just get rid of the diabetes and we're going to be okay, right?
If you could get rid of most of diabetes, overweight, hypertension, et cetera, et cetera,
it's all the same shit. It's all in that bucket.
Now
right?
You're down to you're spending 5% of GDP on medical. You'll never get to zero, maybe even 8%. Do you understand that we would then have staggering sums of money to spend on whatever you want? Mm-hmm. And so when people say you can't afford to have people live longer, I have two of statements I make to them. One, fine, so we'll start with you and we'll kill you when you're 65. And they don't like that idea.
They can raise their hand first.
Yeah, who's going to raise your hand first? But the more important point is that we can't afford not to have these breakthroughs and live longer. But what it does mean is dumb decisions like not saving, mm-hmm. not paying attention in your math class when you're young, not doing whatever. Any mistake you make, if you live longer, punishes you longer. Mm-hmm. And any good decision you make lasts longer if you live longer. And so it does say, virtuous may be the wrong word, live a smarter life, if not a more virtuous life. Save a bit more, save a bit smarter, work a bit longer, be a bit better to your neighbor and your children because they're going to be around a bit longer, you know, those kind of things. Anyway, that's the book, and it's called The Great Age Reboot, and Mike Roizen is the primary author, and I'm involved as a co-author, as is Albert Ratner, and National Geographic is the publisher. It'll be out either at the very end of this year or the start of next year.
Sounds and awesome. Obviously it'll be on Amazon and all the likes. Lineman Associates, LinemanAssociates.com as well. We have it up on the website.
All those places will have it.
Perfect. Gino, give us a little recap here. Give us the GDET specialty.
This has been an amazing show. I don't know where to start, Jake. Maybe back in 1977 when Peter was at the University of Chicago, and in 79, he went to the Wharton Business School, and that first job offer, you should have asked for more. $50 should have been $60.
He got in the game, man.
But that's the thing. I mean, and what I love about it, Jake, it's the 100-year mindset. And right, we have the 100-year real estate investor. That's our brand. And think about it. That's all Peter's talking about. Think for the long term. Don't make decisions based on today or tomorrow. Your decisions are going to affect your children and your grandchildren. And if you start thinking that way and investing that way, you take a little bit of risk off the table and you start making much wiser decisions. So I want to thank
maybe your future cyborg self as well, right? That's what we're talking about. So.
I want to thank Peter for being on and just sharing his wisdom. And I know we can go for hours and hours here, but just go on the website, check out all the information that he has on there, subscribe to his newsletter, and really start thinking for the long term. I mean, that's what this, and what was most uplifting to me, Jake, is that he needed to remind me that this is the greatest country in the world, right?
There's so much
opportunity here. We forget about that, but there is a lot of opportunity. You need to invest in yourself and you need to invest in this economy, my friend.
Wow, Peter, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for sharing your infinite wisdom with us, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.